My panelists with me here are Dana Smith, Executive Director of the Dogwood Alliance, and Scott Barrett, who's an Assistant Professor at Virginia Tech, and Seth Ginter, Executive Director of the U.S. Industrial Pellet Association. And I'll give a slightly longer introduction for each of those in just a minute. I recently visited Green Circle Bioenergy near Cottondale, Florida, which produces 600,000 tons per year of wood pellets from smaller pine trees, sawdust, and wood shavings. You see these massive piles of the smaller diameter trees lined up, just like you would at a paper plant or a pulp mill plant. And the trees are stripped of bark and pulverized in the wood dust and compressed into little pellets that are about an inch and a quarter long and about a quarter inch wide, kind of like a pencil diameter. And it looks more like pet food than something made from trees. And then they were shipped south to Panama City, and where they go on a ship. About 21 rail cars per day go down Panama City. They go on a ship and they go to Europe, where they are used to meet carbon reduction requirements there. The wood pellet harvesting in production has become a contentious issue increasingly. In the past year, last month, Grist Magazine wrote a story called "Europe is Burning Our Forests for Renewable Energy." Wait, what? That was the title. In June, a group of 91 scientists wrote to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency stating that the assumed carbon neutrality of biomass burning is inherently flawed. And a federal study in 2013 said that increasing biomass energy market could lead to price increases for timber products. And under a high-demand scenario, the study said, increased harvesting could harm biodiversity, soil fertility, and water quality. The study emphasized that the forecasting of biomass energy production is highly uncertain. So to kick things off, we'll have Dana Smith. As I said, she's with the Dogwood Alliance. The group says it works to expose the truth about forest destruction and deforestation, while also working collaboratively with industry leaders on innovative business solutions. And Dana's bio says she has successfully negotiated forest protection commitments from some of the world's largest paper producers and corporate consumers. She also serves as co-chair of the Carbon Canopy, which is working to establish a credible carbon market for the South's private forest landowners. She earned her law degree from Emory University and previously was a Greenpeace campaigner. Kick it off.
Well, thanks, Bruce, so much for organizing this panel. I think that, you know, we're at a critical place in time right now where we have the ability to sort of define the role that forests are going to play in the context of climate change. And before we talk about carbon impacts of the wood pellet industry, it's important to recognize that forests are not just trees, right? Forests are ecosystems, and our life depends on the health of the forest ecosystems on this planet. Forests, not only are they critical in terms of storing and removing carbon out of the atmosphere, critical in the context of climate change, standing forests, not log, not burn, but standing forests provide critical ecological climate services that we need to value. Flood control, standing forests prevent floods, and especially in coastal communities that are increasingly vulnerable to the impacts of climate change, maintaining forest cover along the coastal communities is a critical part of the picture moving forward. We saw what happened here in New Orleans when Katrina hit, and the devastation that resulted because of the degradation of wetland forests across the coastal plain. And the economic losses that occurred as a result of that could have been mitigated significantly, according to the reports, if the wetland forests in the deep south had not suffered the degradation that they've suffered over the last century. The third critical role of forests in the context of the future is water purification. They are critical to protect drinking water, and not only to protect our drinking water, but to generate water supplies. So this is the big picture, and right now we're sitting at a point in time where there is global recognition that we are reaching on the brink of disaster in terms of the level of consumption of resources that we are consuming on this planet right now. Okay? We are consuming too much resources too quickly. Okay? There's global recognition happening around that concept. So just this year, I think it was March, the Daily Mail, which is the largest paper in the UK and one of its most conservative papers, wrote a front page story about Europe's rush to burn trees to generate electricity. And the title of that story was Bonfire of Insanity. Shipping wood 3,800 miles across the Atlantic, coming from clear-cut bottomland hardwood wetland forests, burning it in power stations to generate electricity and calling that green is insane. Okay? So the first big issue is this is not carbon beneficial. Okay? The best role that forests can play in the context of the future is for us to leave them standing so that they can absorb and store carbon. The policies that are driving this in Europe operated under a false assumption that burning trees is carbon neutral because trees grow back. So the policies over in Europe are treating burning trees as renewable in the same way as solar and wind power, okay? But over the last couple of years, the scientific community has taken a deeper dive on this issue, and study after study after study has been invalidating that assumption and is suggesting over and over and over again that the burning of wood, whether it be whole trees or large chunks of residuals that would otherwise be left to rot in the woods, are better off staying in the forest from a climate perspective, and that burning it generates more carbon emissions than fossil fuels. So the first thing we have to do is recognize that this is taking us backwards in terms of the future of where we need to be and not forward. The second piece that I want to hit on is the forest impacts, okay? Already around the world, and certainly here in the southern U.S., industrial scale logging and the conversion of natural forest to plantations has taken a toll on ecosystems across the landscape at a landscape level. We have lost certain ecosystems are on the brink of extinction in our region right now, the longleaf pine ecosystem, due to industrial logging practices, large-scale clear-cutting, conversion of natural forest to plantations. And this industry is coming in to a region that is already under significant pressure. It's the world's largest wood and paper producing region already. And now we've just in the last 2 years become the world's largest exporter of wood pellets. Okay? So that's what we're talking about. Entire ecosystems, watersheds, and the increased pressure from this industry is taking us in the wrong direction. We need more forest protection, not less. We need to leave more trees standing, not less. And we need a forest economy in the South that is based on the 21st century context in which we're living. And this wood pellet industry is not taking the forest economy to the 21st century. We need a forest economy that's not based on the degradation and destruction of our natural capital.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dan. I appreciate it. Next up is Seth Ginter, as I mentioned before. He's a Virginia Tech graduate and executive director of the U.S. Industrial Pellet Association. He also is co-managing partner of the Herschler Fleischer Law Firm's Renewable Energy Group. The U.S. Industrial Pellet Association calls itself the leading voice of the wood-based bioenergy industry in the United States. The website lists 62 member companies with some recognizable names, including Shell, CSX, Plum Creek. And as executive director, Seth focuses on issues such as sustainability, shipping, other export issues, and transportation. I mentioned that he's a political science graduate, and he's also a law school graduate of the University of Richmond. Seth, you're up.
Great. Bruce, thank you. Good morning, everybody. As Bruce said, my name is Seth Ginter, and I serve as the executive director of the U.S. Industrial Pellet Association. It's great to be here in New Orleans. It's great to be able to share a panel with Dana and engage in a little bit of debate. You know, what we do in our industry, fundamentally, you know, we share the views of many of the things that Dan is talking about. You know, our industry is about displacing coal, pulling fossil fuels out of the energy stream and replacing that with renewable fuel. Our industry is about creating more forests and not less. If you look historically in the U.S. over the past 60 years, because of the forest products industry, there is more tree cover today than there was yesterday, and it's projected that there will be more tomorrow than there is today. And that's because there are forest markets. In a little bit, we can kind of get into that. We're also for sequestering more carbon in our forests rather than less. And we believe that what we are doing contributes to that in a big way. Monday, the Society of American Foresters, which is made up of 12,000 professional foresters and scientists whose career is to basically look after the forests here in the U.S., will release a report. They have sat down and they have looked at every report that has been published to date, some of the reports that Dana is speaking about relating to carbon benefits and things like that, of bioenergy. And in this book, which they're available in the back, there's a summary of that report on page 6. But the report basically recognizes the benefits of bioenergy. And if you begin to look at many of these models that are out there and many of the reports that are out there, they all say the same thing, and that is, done properly, you can realize an incredible carbon benefit out of using bioenergy. Many of the reports that Dana has cited actually make wrong assumptions on the kind of fiber and the amount that is being used in bioenergy. So we can talk a little bit about that, I'm sure, within the debate here, but that's an exciting report that's coming out on Monday. Dana cited some studies relating to impacts on forest cover in the U.S. and what European demand is doing to forest cover. Dana's colleagues in the Netherlands, Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, a number of other NGOs are working with many of our customers, the generators, and the Dutch government to come up with a criteria for solid biomass, a sustainability criteria for solid biomass. And in that work, the request was made from that group that the Dutch government actually commission a report to see if the demand from European bioenergy would have any negative impact on U.S. forests. And that report was just published in July of 2014. It's right here. It was done by Poorly Management Consulting, one of the leading independent management consulting companies in the world, that found that there was no adverse impact relating to the demand for bioenergy in Europe as it relates to U.S. forests. And looking ahead, they did not see any. In fact, they found a number of benefits. And let me tell you why. These are two fundamental things. What our industry is using, we're using low-grade wood fiber. We are using byproducts of other forest product industries. So we use residues, we use tops and limbs, we use commercial thinnings, we use diseased and deformed wood and things of that nature. We can't afford to use saw timber. The cost of saw timber is some three to four times what the cost of the fiber is that we actually use. If we use saw timber, we would go out of business very, very quickly. Our business is built on using the residues and the byproducts of other forest product industries, and we look forward to talking about that a little bit more as well. I think one of the key things that we need to remember is that the reason that we have such great forest cover in the U.S. is because the majority of those forests are owned by private landowners. And those private landowners many times are small landowners who own, you know, maybe 10 or 20 acres of forest land. in order for those landowners to keep those forests for us and to pass those forests down to the next generation, they have to be economically incentivized to keep those forests for us. You have to provide an economic incentive to those small landowners so that they can keep those forests working, so that they can harvest them and so that they can regrow them. And our industry is playing a role in allowing markets where many of those markets have disappeared because other industries have gone away. So I want to thank everybody again for allowing us the opportunity to speak today. Very much looking forward to your questions and looking forward to the debate. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Seth. I appreciate it very much. Scott Barrett is up next, batting cleanup. He's an assistant professor of forest operations and biomass utilization at Virginia Tech. He also serves as the coordinator of the Sustainable Harvesting and Resource Professional Logging Program. He's been involved in research projects related to biomass harvesting and the use of forestry best management practices, which are designed to protect water quality. And he earned his PhD and his other degrees from Virginia Tech. Scott, thank you for filling in.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to be here. He didn't mention, but I'm also filling in for our department head, Jonicky.
You need to put that right up there.
All right. Is this better? Can you hear me now?
Okay. Yep.
No, I can talk loud.
He's a professor.
I'm used to training loggers, and I can talk loud. So our department head, Jonicky Olivalapati, was one of the authors on the report that Bruce mentioned earlier, the U.S. Forest Service Southern Forest Futures Project. And unfortunately, he had a last-minute conflict and couldn't be here, so I'll be filling in for him today. But I am an extension specialist in forest operations. So forest operations are kind of the harvesting and transportation side of forestry. In Virginia, in the past 5 or 6 years, there's been quite a bit of interest and talk about biomass utilization. Not just for pellets, but for burning as well. And we've done a number of extension programs across the state, not just for loggers, but for landowners and foresters and others that are managing the forest. So there's always been a lot of questions about that. You know, we don't necessarily advocate for or against the wood pellet industry. We see them as another user of wood. You know, there's already existing forest industries using wood. We feel that the more competition there is out there, the more users of wood, the more benefits there are for forest landowners. As Seth mentioned, when there is a market incentive, when there is profit to be made in owning forest land, there will be more forest land. Forest landowners do need to make a profit off of the land that they have. It is a new industry. Pellets, some of the loggers that are harvesting wood now to produce pellets, their equipment is older than this industry. So it's kind of unfamiliar to a lot of people, and they kind of have it in their mind. You know, when you can use very small, very low-quality wood to make a pellet, something the size of this, when your product is turned into sawdust and then it's made into pellets, you can use very small, low-quality wood. So a lot of people have it in their mind that this is going to be a drastically different harvesting operation, you could, in theory, be out there raking up all the limbs off the ground and even pulling the stumps out of the ground to make pellets out of. But from an operational point of view, that just simply doesn't happen. With a conventional harvesting system and a conventional harvesting operation, it's just simply not economically feasible to go after things like small twigs and stumps. Most of what's being harvested, was attached or used for pellets, was attached to a tree that was planned on being harvested for pellets. You just don't feel feasible to go back out and rake the ground and come up with additional stuff. So a biomass harvest or a harvest where they're producing pellets or, fuel chips for co-firing, it looks very similar to a conventional forest harvesting operation. Some of the research I did was in the Virginia Piedmont, where we compared biomass harvest with conventional harvest. Now, we were looking at it from the perspective of water quality. So most of our focus was on BMP implementation and the water quality impacts. And we found no differences in erosion rates, and we found no differences in BMP implementation between biomass and conventional. And again, that was in the Piedmont of Virginia. But, most harvest sites, they're producing multiple products. When you see a truckload of logs leaving a harvest site, you wouldn't necessarily know whether they're going to a paper mill or a pellet mill. They would basically look identical. So very similar harvesting operations, very similar harvest characteristics, and what the site looks like after it's done. Again, that's with conventional harvesting operations with today's markets. It is still a developing market. I think it's yet to be determined how it's going to end up. But I see when working with forest landowners and others that are involved in harvesting and transportation, there's a lot of optimism across Virginia. They see this as a new industry that could benefit them as they have more markets for their products, especially in the southeastern part of the state, which was particularly hard hit with the recession, where a lot of conventional forest industries went out of business with the recession, 2009, 2010. And there just simply were not markets for some of those products. And so now, with new biomass markets moving in, there are markets again for those products. So with that, I will pass it over to you, and we'll be ready for questions.
Thank you very much, Scott. And we do want to get as many questions in from you all as possible. The blue tags for SEJ member journalists get first priority. And we'll make sure we repeat all of the questions. One question I'll just throw out is that it seems to be interesting that these are, with these being wood pellets that are going overseas, it's almost like bottled water in Florida. There's just something about putting that water in a bottle and having it go off in a truck that just changes the dynamic of the discussion. Do you see that being the case with wood pellets? I mean, if this was being made into paper, wouldn't it be the same kind of tree harvesting? What do you think about that, Dana?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to, thank you for your presentation. I really appreciate it. I think we're on the same page that, this industry looks very much like, paper industry, okay? And anybody who's lived in the southern region and has been paying attention to these issues for the last couple of decades can very clearly document that when the paper industry went through a major expansion, there was increased logging, increased clear cutting, and massive conversion of natural forest to pine plantations. You know, I was just looking at the cover of this magazine, World Biomass. Look at the cover of this. You know, this is not a forest. These are planted trees, okay? This is not the future. This is the same old that we've seen from the paper industry over the last several decades. This is nothing new. This industry ties its, claims that it is sustainable, claims that it's a part of the green energy revolution into the future. But the arguments that are being made are arguments we've heard over and over and over again by the paper industry. We're not driving logging. We're not responsible for clear cutting. We don't take saw timber, so therefore the other 75% of the forest that's not saw timber, somehow, taking that out of the forest means there's no impact. Okay? We've heard these arguments before. Same, same old, same old. That's what we're talking about here. This is not forest management for the 21st century. This is not the appropriate industry that is going to take us into the future and protect the forests that are so vital to the quality of life and life on this planet.
Seth, do you want to respond to that at all? I mean, one thing that comes to mind is that my house was built 10 years ago on land that was owned by the St. Joe Paper Company. It's no longer paper company land. The St. Joe Company doesn't produce paper anymore. It sells land for development. I mean,
Well, they still produce paper. But they just don't own the
paper. No, they don't. They tore down their paper.
Oh, okay.
They tore down their paper mill.
Bruce, I mean, I think that's exactly the point from a market perspective. I mean, that's the danger. The land that your house was on at one time was a commercial working forest that offered all of the environmental attributes and everything else that Dana is talking about. And what do you have on it now? You have a house on it that's not sequestering any carbon or doing anything like that. And what is at risk? And Dana, I mean, I would respectfully disagree with you. I mean, this absolutely, we've got to find ways to continue to keep our forests working. And the only way you do that is markets. And what is at risk is exactly what Bruce's house demonstrates, is that these landowners go out and they can no longer make any money from holding those forestry holdings, and they convert it to real estate development. and forests are never coming back on those developments. And so what you've got to do is you've got to create markets across a broad array of forest products so that you can keep those forests working. And is it St. Joe? Is that the company that you were talking about, Bruce?
Yes.
So that's one example of kind of a big corporate landowner slash paper manufacturer. But in reality, when you look at the U.S. Southeast and particularly the folks that we source from, 89% of the fiber that we source from is sourced from small landowners. These are folks that own 10, 20, 30 acres. This acreage has been in their family for generations. They use it recreationally to hunt. They want nothing more than to pass this land down to their children and to their grandchildren. But every year, a tax bill arrives in their mailbox from the locality that says you owe X amount of dollars for, you know, owning this inventory here. And they've got to pay that. They've got to make an income off of those things. And so what they do is, in a very sustainable way, you know, they're able to go through these harvests. And our industry does play in that. One thing I did want to point out, though, you know, Damon, you keep saying clear cut it. And, you know, I am not aware of any harvest in the U.S. Southeast where a pellet manufacturer has come in and, or a logging crew that is sourcing to that pellet manufacturer and has clear cut a parcel for bioenergy.
Okay.
When clear cutting is happening, and clear cutting, by the way, is a, you know, is a commercial forestry operation, it's happening because those landowners are selling saw timber. The most valuable piece of fiber that a landowner can sell is that saw timber. They're going to grow that product so that they can sell saw timber.
There's so much I need to respond to.
If I can finish my statement, that would be great. They grow that product for saw timber. They harvest for saw timber, and when they harvest that product for saw timber, there are byproducts that are left over. And we come in and use those byproducts and offer yet another income stream for those landowners. So I think we need to be very careful when we talk about clear cutting, because you know, that's not what's happening in bioenergy.
Can I have to say something?
You go ahead, and then I'll.
Since I am stuck in the middle here.
Just repeat your name for the recording.
Yeah, so Scott Barrett. Just since I do work for a forestry school, I just would like to point out and say a few words about clear cutting. Clear cutting does get a bad rap. However, clear cutting is a sound silvicultural. It's a good forest management practice for regenerating shade intolerant species. So it is, you know, you pull out your silvicultural textbook, it is a regeneration method when the species you're trying to manage for is shade intolerant. A lot of our commercial species, like loblolly pine, a lot of the oaks and hickory sweet gum, those type of species need full sunlight to reproduce and to generate a new stand. And so that's why the clear cutting method removes all of the other stories so you get full sunlight out there for regenerating those stands. Now, it can have some pretty dramatic visual impacts. Everybody would acknowledge that. But from a forest management point of view, I wouldn't necessarily say that clear cutting is a bad thing.
But you're talking about forest regeneration for species that are commercially valuable. That's right? I mean, I just want to be clear about that. What you're not referring to is the ecological integrity of the ecosystem.
Yeah, that's why it is used fairly often, because it is for commercially valuable species, but the regeneration method itself is for shade intolerant species, regardless of what, you know, their value.
Okay, we're going to get the Q&A now. First question?
I didn't get a chance to respond.
Sorry, I jumped in front of you there.
This idea of, you know, the saw timber industry driving everything that happens in the woods is a little bit like pointing the finger and not taking responsibility. The wood pellet industry in Viva, the South's biggest wood pellet manufacturer, was exposed on the front page of the Wall Street Journal last year, sourcing from a clear-cut bottomland hardwood wetland forest. Okay? So in today's world, you have to take responsibility for the impacts down through your supply chain. the industry is sourcing from clear cut forests. What are you going to do about that? Okay. Second thing is that, you know, this idea that the saw timber industry is the only reason why landowners clear cut. Okay. True. Landowners are going to try to maximize the value of their forest, right? So saw timber does bring a higher value than pulpwood and other low-grade material, right? But the amount of volume in a forest that is of saw timber quality is a fraction of the overall trees that exist on the landscape. So the fact that there is value for all that other stuff is driving the clearing of that forest as opposed to using more of a group selection or selective logging type forest management, okay? So the presence of strong markets for pulpwood drive the cutting of pulpwood, okay? Clear. So if you've got a pulpwood market and you have a saw timber market, what are you going to get? You're going to get a clear cut because everything has some value in that forest, whereas if there were no markets, that stuff would not have value and the landowners would leave those smaller diameter trees to grow into the future to create more value as saw timber. The second thing I have to respond to is this, you know, these markets are keeping our forests in forests, okay? Historical data does not support the fact, the assertion that, you know, if there's a strong market for wood, that it prevents forests from being developed, okay? The historical data just doesn't support that. At the height of the 1990s big expansion in the wood products industry across the South, the timber prices were way, way up. And you know what? They couldn't compete with the price of development because development was out of control during that same period. Because the fact of the matter is that if a landowner, you know, is faced with the choice of getting, you know, if the development pressures are real, as they probably were in your situation, the $2 to $5 a ton that you're paying for wood is not going to stop that landowner from getting $1 million, okay? Cash for that development. And development is concentrated in certain areas. A lot of what's happening across the South in terms of, you know, the wood products industry is happening in places where development pressures don't exist. I mean, they don't. I've been to the rural South of these massive, you know, areas of industrial forestry. There's not a lot of pressure there for development, I can tell you. So there may be some marginal cases where that may be true, but that is a very small percentage of scenarios that would actually occur on the landscape.
Okay, we're going to jump into Q&A now, and I'm going to try to meet the audience.
I'm a yellow. Sure. My name is Celia Alario. I teach at UC Santa Barbara. And I guess my interest, first off, I think it's worth acknowledging the skew of the panel. A fourth person who maybe was focused less on quote unquote forest operations and wildlife ecosystem health would probably balance the panel a little bit better. No disrespect. Thank you for putting together, Bruce. But I guess what I'd love to is to hear a little more conversation unpacking. There's been a phrase forest cover and tree cover used, and then there's been forest. And I think to me this is the nuance and the challenge, which is this conversation of what is forest cover or tree cover, and that renewable then as a resource to produce more biomass and tree product or pulp product versus a working forest from an ecosystem perspective, which includes the full spectrum of life, and you know, unfortunately, there is no market for, you know, the works of the earthworm and the fungi and everybody else. But if there was a different kind of economic math, then perhaps we wouldn't be having the same conversation. So I'd love to hear Scott Seth unpack a little bit more where in your conversation is the full spectrum of what a healthy ecosystem is, which means that all of the traditional forest species are present, and it's not, you know, that we're not just sort of apex folks that we like to hunt, but the whole spectrum. And does that figure into what you're talking about?
pass the mic down there or not?
Oh, sure.
All right, now I'm going to have to start off by apologizing. Could you went through quite a different topics there. Which one would you like me to address first? The forest cover or... in general, we, you know, as forest managers, you know, forestry students are taught to diversify, you know, for any landowner, if they want to have lots of different types of things, if they want wildlife, if they want timber income, you know, diversify the forest stands that they have there. You had a question, I think, of forest cover versus forest.
The whole suite of the forest.
It's literally just, it's an attitude. It's a perspective on value, in a way, is what the challenge is. What I'm hearing is that for you all, the value is in things that can be generated quickly, profit, extraction, and right now, because of where you sit and what marketplace you're in, your perspective on it sounds like the profit is in the trees that can be harvested. For people who think about full ecosystem value, the quote unquote value, not in a necessarily monetizable way, but the value is calculated in, is the full diversity of species there? You know, what's the health?
Can you just summarize the question?
Yeah.
My question.
Okay. Yeah, I guess it's just a reflection that it sounds like the reason why this perspective works for you is
my question is actually a little bit related to me, and it's a question.
Thanks, Dave. Just try.
I'm Dave Lewis, I'm a freelancer from Philadelphia. I'm just curious because you were talking about profiting off land, if there's any chance that if there was a price on carbon, if that could be included, if like you own some forests, does the carbon sequestered there trump any, could it, I guess, depending on the price? Do you have any thoughts on the price on carbon and how it relates to forestry in general?
Sure, I can talk about that. We're actually working with private landowners right now and some of the biggest companies in the world, Coca-Cola, Staples, some of the biggest wood products companies, Domtar, big paper company, and Columbia Forest Products, big producer of hardwood plywood, on that very issue. It's like, how do we begin to flip this economic challenge where landowners aren't faced with, you know, the dilemma of, you know, cutting their forest down to generate revenue and can actually leave trees in the woods and generate revenue. So the big thing that's getting some traction right now in the marketplace is carbon, right? And what we've learned through that process, okay, of doing these projects on the ground with private landowners in the southern U.S. is that right now we're just not valuing carbon on the landscape. You know, Enviva and other company, wood pellet manufacturers, are getting financed hand over fist to build out capacity on wood pellet production, to turn forests into pellets and burn the carbon into the atmosphere. And there's very little market traction or a price of carbon available to landowners to be able to protect their forests as carbon sinks. So this is a critical piece of the picture moving forward. And absolutely, if we valued carbon on the landscape, landowners wouldn't have to log their forests to generate revenue, but there would be actually be a market for protecting forests on the landscape. And that's where we need to get to. That's a critical part of the solution.
One thing to think about in all of that is, and I think we're talking about forest economics now. Seth Ginther. We're talking about forest economics now is, you know, as a tree grows, at a point it is saturated with carbon and it stops. It sequesters the carbon that it has, but it doesn't absorb additional carbon. Trees don't grow indefinitely into, you know, the sky. There's a point where they stop. And so, you know, when you look at that from an economic perspective, in our opinion, if you're doing something where you're able to regenerate trees, you know, you're continually sequestering more and more carbon rather than having that carbon sit there statically. So I mean that's something to think about when you look at, you know, you begin talking about the price of carbon and other things.
Are you familiar with the recent study that just came out this year in Nature?
the older a tree, the longer the tree grows, the faster it pulls carbon out of the atmosphere. So the best thing we can do from a carbon perspective in terms of managing forests in the context of climate change is to let them grow.
But
leave them in the ground, let them grow.
But that tree stops growing at some point, correct?
This most recent article talks about how trees will continue to grow. And the older it gets, okay, so here's the thing. When we cut forests down at 40 years, right, we're losing the opportunity of that forest to continue to sequester carbon into the future. And the older that tree gets, the more carbon it's pulling out of the atmosphere. So, again, the best thing that we can do is to protect forests and to leave trees in the ground to grow. Because the older they get, the more carbon they store.
Next question.
And that's just science. I mean.
Okay, we'll go 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah, Janet Rawls at Science News. It just struck me that one thing you were saying is that once the trees stop growing, then it sort of makes it okay to harvest them with pellets, except the pellets will burn them and release the carbon right away. So that seems like a false economy. If it's going into timber, at least it's staying in a house for 30 to 50 years or more. But you put it into pellets and it seems like you're releasing the carbon immediately, which is a false economy if you're going to try and justify on the basis of carbon storage.
So the products, again, that we're using are low-grade wood fiber. So this is the fiber that in many instances would be left behind in the forest, would be left on the forest floor to rot, which releases methane and carbon and other things in the area, or would actually be gathered into the center of where that area is and burned. And why burn that and not get a renewable, you know, an energy benefit out of that, as opposed to just leaving it and doing it without realizing any benefit out of that?
Well, it wasn't the argument you were making. You changed the metric there. It was a little bit of bait and switch. But actually, that's not the question I really wanted to ask. I was on a tour on Thursday, and we went through cypress forests. And the argument there by the forest people we were listening to was that you had 100-year-old cypress trees that were being harvested for mulch, and increasingly the move was going to be to harvest them for pellets for use in Europe. Is that part of your industry at this point, or is that something that's just supposition on the part of people who are worried about the loss of cypress forests in southern Louisiana?
I believe that's supposition on the part of those folks. Again, you know, our industry would not be able to afford to pay the fiber costs of harvesting something like that would clearly be used for sawtimber.
But they're using it right now for mulch. It's more valuable than...
Well, I can't speak for the mulch industry.
But I mean, if it's good enough for one, it seems to me the economics would be about equivalent, at least for yours.
I can't speculate on that. But what I can tell you is that, you know, our industry is not using saw timber, nor will it in the future.
Okay. Scott, can you address all the BMTs you may or may not allow for harvesting wetland areas? I know it varies by state and varies by...
It does vary by state, and wetland BMPs are not a big area of my specialty. I focus
mainly...
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm back up. Best management practices. Typically, best management practices are related to water quality, but there are also other issues related to site quality. So every state in the U.S., I'll give you a little more history on it. So the EPA, you know, has charged the state forestry agencies with regulating non-point source pollution. And so typically each state has their regulatory agency, or quite often their state forestry agency is responsible for making sure that harvesting operations use BMPs to protect water quality. Okay, that answers the BMP part of it. There are specific BMPs related to wetlands. Typically, we don't have that many wetlands in Virginia. Most of what we do have that would be jurisdictional wetlands are near the stream. We don't have like wide expanses like you see here in Louisiana. That's just not something we have much of in Virginia. But as far as BMPs in Virginia, we do recommend a 50-foot wide buffer on either side of the stream. So at least most cypress I've ever seen in Virginia would be within that SMZ, and so probably wouldn't be harvested anyways. But I can't really speak as far as the wetlands like you visited here.
You know, every time we followed a logging truck coming back, every time we followed logging trucks from the Enviva facility, we end up at a wetland forest. Let's be clear, Pat.
Next question.
Hi, I'm Chelsea Walden, with the United Surveys in Vienna, Austria. And I have a basic question from sort of the European side. Where exactly are these fellows going? You mentioned the Netherlands and there's other countries. And also, where else are these plants sourcing their wood from other continents, and even through forests in Europe? So why are they getting
there? Sure. So the main markets for
name?
Yes, ma'am.
Your name?
If we could just reintroduce ourselves, the male voice.
Seth Cooper. The main markets right now are the United Kingdom, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Denmark. And typically, you are seeing the majority of the imports to those countries coming from North America, the U.S. and Canada. You ask why are they sourcing that from across the ocean as opposed to, you know, maybe more domestically or kind of in the countries that are closer by. Two reasons. Forest cover in those countries is a fraction of what it is here in the U.S. They do not have the same natural resource that we do. And secondly, from a greenhouse gas perspective, the greenhouse gas footprint to ship in bulk across the entire supply chain, so from forest all the way to getting it across the ocean, is much better on a in a bulk load of pellets than the greenhouse gas footprint of shipping a much smaller amount of that by diesel truck, across a couple hundred miles in Europe.
I think it's important, too, for people to realize that there was just a report that came out of the Department of Energy and Climate Change in the UK, okay? And the UK is really at the forefront of this right now with their biggest coal burner moving to wood. And in the UK government has spent, you know, 62-plus million pounds of dollars in subsidies to convert this Drax coal-burning plant to wood. Okay, so given all the controversy around what's happened, the Department of Energy and Climate Change has been studying the issue of the carbon footprint of the biomass industry. And, you know, this is an agency that has every reason to want to find science to validate the status quo, right? Because they've put a lot of investment in this direction, okay? That report just came out last month. And that report basically documents that whether it's whole trees coming out of forests that have been logged in the southern U.S., or it's large residual material, anything greater than 4 inches, and I can tell you, because we've been to these facilities, that the stuff they're calling residual is way bigger than 4 inches, that it releases more carbon in total when you take the whole life cycle combined than fossil fuels, and is not, you know, sufficient carbon benefit to justify the continued subsidies that are intended to help Europe achieve carbon emission reductions. So this is coming out of the Department of Energy and Climate Change. And in, as a result of that report release, the government agency basically acknowledged that they've made a big mistake. Now the question is going to be, what are they going to do about it? So I think that's something that, you know, that the wood pellet industry needs to really internalize and understand and align its feedstocks with the report that came out of the DEC report. Now, the only scenarios, there were only a few scenarios that came out positive from a climate perspective. And one of those was, you know, small residuals under 4 inches and mill waste, okay? So that's, if we're gonna grow this industry, you know, if we're gonna rely on wood as a fuel source for helping to reduce carbon emissions, the feedstocks going into these mills need to be limited to those sources. And that's far different from what the industry looks like right now.
Seth Gemper, Dana, you've done a fantastic job mischaracterizing the DEC report and the BAG model. What Dana is referencing is actually something called the BAG calculator, which was headed up by a gentleman named David McKay, who was the chief scientist for the Department of Energy and Climate Change. And what the BAG calculator is, in fact, is not a policy tool or a regulatory tool. It is a tool, it is a first draft of a tool that the Department of Climate and Energy Change has put together so that developers of bioenergy facilities can play with the different scenarios and assumptions that are out there. There are 44 assumptions, I believe, in that BAC calculator so that you can sit at that calculator, and I would encourage you all to go on to the DEC website and play with the assumptions, and you can say, if I source, you know, this kind of fiber under this kind of assumption to make a pellet, what would the carbon benefits of that be? By DEC's own admission, that calculator is in its first stages and it does not take into account the market impacts or the economic impacts that are associated with those assumptions, and they will be continuing to work to what they've done is built a foundation. But we actually applaud the publication of that calculator. It says exactly what we've been saying all along. There's a right way to do bioenergy, and there's a wrong way to do bioenergy. And words matter, and definitions matter, and feedstocks matter. And so we're working very closely with the Department of Energy and Climate Change to provide them with information to make sure that biomass is in fact done properly. But that's what the BAC calculator does. When that calculator was released, Secretary of State for Energy, Ed Davey, stated emphatically on the front page of it, bioenergy sourced sustainably has a major role to play in UK energy policy. And to sit here and say that the Department of Energy and Climate Change came out and said we made a mistake is just absolutely false. Please go to the webpage and see what Secretary of State Ed Davey says about the use of bioenergy. Facts matter.
It's quoted in the news, okay, around this, okay? So it may be in their executive summary, but there's one. I've got to respond to this because there are two scenarios that pretty much define the current feedstocks in the wood pellet industry in the southern U.S. that are relevant here, okay? Which is a big part of the feedstock going into these mills. One is pulpwood log, okay? Pulpwood trees cut and then turned into wood pellets. The other is residual material above 4 inches. Okay, those two feedstocks right there comprise a majority of the wood that's being used to turn into wood pellets. And under those two scenarios, the DEC report found that burning that material releases more carbon than fossil fuels.
Okay, so let me see who's got, who's left with one question. 1, 2, 3. Okay. Let me pass now. What is the issue here?
You're currently a freelancer from British Columbia. It seems like there's a basic kind of fact of the forestry process question hanging out there that you can help with, Scott, and that is, are there, when you're doing biomass, are you getting more stuff off the forest floor that would otherwise have stayed there and rotted, or is it essentially the same? And then a second question in terms of the question David asked with carbon pricing. Is there a carbon price that would really change the behavior of the industry in terms of taking biomass versus leaving?
Okay, so for your question related to the forest floor, as a general rule, like so with residue harvesting where you have a chipper on your operation where you can chip the material, and that could either be burned in, you know, a wood-fired power plant, or in some cases it could be used for pellets as well. As a general rule, no, you're not picking anything up off of the forest floor. Anything on the forest floor will be dead. Two big operational reasons why you don't do that. One, with the skidders they have, when you pick those dead logs up, they break, they fall apart, and you can't bring them back. And then the other operational issue is the chipper itself. It is very difficult to chip either dry or dead material. It's hard on your chipper knives. You know, it's got more contamination in it, more stuff that the facilities don't want. So no, you're not picking anything up off of the forest floor. Now, with that being said, you know, a harvest site after you have harvested for biomass may have less dead woody material on the forest floor than if you had harvested it conventionally and left some of that material out there. Okay, because some of the stuff that you cut down that you otherwise would have left, you know, the tops and stuff, they're not there because they went through the chipper. But not actually picking anything up off of the forest floor to chip.
And going back to the fact, I think Scott and I are, Seth Gipper, I think that Scott and I are saying the same thing. When we talk about forest residues, what we're talking about is somebody who's going in and harvesting a saw tree. They're taking off the limbs. What we're going in is in taking is that, not something that may have been laying around there for, you know, 20 years prior to that. So when we say forest residuals, that's what we mean by that.
And I sometimes assume people know more about logging operations than you actually do, so. But with a typical southern mechanized harvesting operation, the way it works is you mechanically fell the tree out in the stand, then you drag it back with a skidder to a centralized landing, whole tree, limbs and everything still on. At that point, you manufacture it into something else. You'll either strip the limbs off, cut it into pulpwood or saw timber-sized lengths, and then you've got all that pile of residues there you have to do something with. If you have markets for biomass, you can put that through a chipper. If you don't have markets for biomass, you either A, leave it right there, you have a big pile of stuff on the landing, or B, you drag it back into the forest site and put piles out in the forest site. So if that helps clear it up a little bit.
Hi, my name is Jeremy Hansen. I'm with MamaBay.com. I have two quick questions. One is, you sort of had different characteristics of what these forests look like not from this region. So are we talking primarily plantations, or are we talking primarily second growth, you know, fragmented? I mean, there's no old growth forests really left as far as I understand this region, unfortunately. And the other question is, in much of the world, you have to do like environmental impact assessments. You have to figure out what biodiversity is in the region, what species are there, and, you know, I think people are starting to measure for soil carbon. And we've talked a lot about carbon in the trees, but I'm wondering about other impacts. I'm wondering about biodiversity impacts, and I'm wondering about when you're bringing these machines in and what you're doing to the, and we talked a little bit about water. I'm really curious about wildlife, and I'm really curious about soil issues as well, erosion and things like that. So I'm wondering if are there assessments done? Does the government require assessments, or is this sort of a wild west harvesting kind of a thing, and unregulated, basically, in that sense?
So we are harvesting from or our you know, suppliers are harvesting from commercial working forests. These are for the most part forests that have been harvested in the past and will be harvested in the future. When it comes to things such as soil quality and biodiversity and other things of that nature, it is absolutely not the Wild West. I mean, in fact, our members here, they're contractually obligated to their customers in Europe to adhere to one of, actually the most stringent set of sustainability criteria for solid biomass that have ever been established. As everybody knows, the market for bioenergy in Europe is a subsidy-based market. So from a public policy perspective, what has happened is the citizens, through the politicians, have gotten together and said, look, we'll pay more for green energy. But in doing that, in paying these subsidies, we need proof as a government that what you are doing is being done sustainably and it's protecting, you know, protecting all of those things. And so again, let's take the UK for example. If you go to the Department of Energy and Climate Change website, they established back in August of 2013 the most robust set of stringent set of sustainability criteria for solid biomass. That goes through biodiversity and soil erosion and wetlands and other things. And our members have to follow all of those rules. They have to do that contractually, but more importantly, they're audited. They're audited by independent third parties, folks of the likes of Bureau Veritas or PwC or Control Union or SGS, who go on an annual basis into the woods and inspect the supply chain and say, look, what that company is telling you is absolutely true, and they pass those audits and they pass those certifications. Our members also hold a number of forestry certifications, including SFI, FSC, PEFC, a number of other forestry certifications that underpin not only our industry, but the timber industry, the pulp and paper industry. So from a U.S. perspective, government oversight perspective in the woods, and Scott is probably better suited to address this than me, but all of the suppliers that our members work with operate under best management practices for those states and are in compliance with all of the federal, state, and local laws, including the Endangered Species Act, the National Air Act, all of those types of things. Maybe Scott can shed a little bit more light on the types of government oversight in logging operations. Sure.
To answer another part of your question, so in the Southeast, this is predominantly private landowners. I think it's like 90% of the forest land in the South is privately owned. Somewhere between 20 and 25% of that, I think, is the numbers, but it's actual pine plantation. So the rest would be naturally regenerated, either pine or hardwoods. So in most cases, you know, it's up to the forest landowner to decide, you know, what attributes they want to manage for. But in, at least in the Southeast, the water quality issues are the primary regulatory issue. You know, we have more familiar with Virginia, but as an example, in Virginia, every timber harvesting operation is inspected by our Department of Forestry. So we have a notification law which requires them to notify, let them know that they are going to be harvesting timber, and the Department of Forestry comes out and inspects for water quality related issues. So every site is harvested for water quality. And the reason being, you know, that's the main possible off-site impact. You know, you don't want a harvesting operation to impact water quality, which could, you know, have implications further downstream. So that's why throughout the Southeast, the state forestry agencies pay a lot of attention to water quality-related issues.
You know, we're under the stringent requirements in Europe that you pointed to, under, you know, a voluntary, largely BMP program, certification systems that still are in development. The only credible one is FSC. The others allow for lots of stuff that they shouldn't allow for in order to be able to claim some kind of sustainability. But, you know, look, all of that you just mentioned, and at the end of the day, this industry is sourcing from bottomland, hardwood, wetland forests in the U.S. South that have been clear cut. Okay? It all comes back to that. What is the evidence? What's actually happening on the ground? Okay? There are no standards out there right now that are preventing that. And these bottomland, hardwood, wetland forests are, you know, they are the lifeline for so many species that exist along the coastal plain in a broad ecoregion that has largely been converted from natural forests to pine plantations. The bottomland hardwood forests are like an oasis in the middle of a desert, okay? 30% of migratory songbirds and migratory birds traveling from the Amazon to the boreal forest depend on mature, not clear-cut, mature bottomland hardwood forests for their survival. Bottomland hardwood forests have been a major area of focus for the conservation community, ecologists, land trusts, and they're critical not just from the perspective of biodiversity in this region, but they are critical in terms of flood protection in the wake of a changing climate. And I really worry about the health of our rural communities in the context of increasing impacts of climate change along the coast. And cutting down our wetland forests and turning them into wood pellets and burning them into the atmosphere is not going to do anything to help those communities, and in fact, it's going to exacerbate the problem. So, laws or no laws, the reality of what's happening on the ground is a big concern for people that live in these communities, for people who are focused on forest conservation and ecology of a landscape that has been, you know, heavily, heavily impacted. Okay? And your industry, the wood pellet industry, is sourcing from mature bottomland hardwood wetland forests. And you have to take accountability for that stuff. You know, the industry has to assume responsibility.
We got a last question.
Two-part question. Hello, my name is Tyson Miller. I'm with the project from the Environmental Federation. And I heard Mr. Barrett mention that if you go to a site for biomass harvesting, it looks pretty much the same as the traditional commercial operations. So I'm a little confused relative to the notion that it's all residuals and it's all under orange tag.
It's not.
So that was one piece, because I heard that there was, it looks the same. I just want to clarify that one. The other one is, I recall reading a report in Nature, I'm forgetting the issue of his name, but the title of it, look up, was Fixing a Critical Climate Error. And he was initially involved in basically, you know, the notion that harvesting the landscape for whatever products we use is carbon neutral. And the assertion of this article is that was a fatal county error, and that, you know, there's a lot of work going on right now to address that. But does that fundamentally shift that sort of notion, is that this isn't carbon neutral? Does that shift the equation and the dynamics and the markets and the landscape?
So I guess I'll take the first part of that question.
Your name?
I'm sorry. I'm Scott Barrett. So what I was referring to is a research project that I did, and we actually, all of the harvest we went to were clear cut harvest. You know, clear cut is a very common practice in the Southeast, so everything we went to were clear cuts.
Clear cut for timber?
Yes, they were clear. This was in the Piedmont, Virginia, to, just for the record, none of it was going to pellet mills.
But was any going to pulp mills?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, in that market, the primary biomass market is for direct combustion in power plants.
Yeah.
Okay, so they were harvesting saw timber, pulpwood, and then the residues were being chipped to go for biomass energy. Would be a very similar process to what could happen with material going to a pellet mill. There just were no pellet mill markets in that particular area. So,
but the stem is not going to bioenergy, correct?
Well, we were there after the harvest was completed. But in general, yes, you're harvesting the residues. You know, so pulpwood goes to paper mills, saw timber goes to sawmills, and whatever's left over is typically what's chipped to be burned for biomass. So to get back to my statement, it's sometimes hard to tell the difference. So these are all clear cuts, and we were following them up. We were using the Department of Forestry's audit procedures, which they basically look at stuff 6 months after it's been harvested. So again, because our perspective was looking at it from a water quality point of view, we want to see what these sites look like, you know, after they've moved on and they're starting to regenerate. So we were using the DOF audit procedures, which basically means 6 months after they're closed out. So you're going to a stand that's been clear cut, you know, approximately 6 months previously, the loggers are gone. And so when you look out to on the forest site there, that's where I was getting at, was that it's actually sometimes hard to tell the difference. In fact, some cases, we were looking around the land where the equipment was, trying to figure out if there's some chips left on site, just to verify if there actually was biomass harvesting occurring there. So that was in the context of on a clear cut harvesting operation. The main difference is that you see there is less large woody debris out on the site, because some of that was used for biomass.
But again, as I mentioned, we didn't see any differences in erosion. Didn't see any differences in bare soil, which if you had more bare soil out there, then that would be a concern. Like I said, no difference in white slash. So the really small stuff that was either on the forest floor to start with or broke off when the tree hit the ground, no differences in light slash. But again, there was less heavy slash, so there would be less forest woody debris out there.
We've got just 2 minutes left.
Okay.
He was asking about carbon neutrality and if that changes.
Sure. So
what does that mean?
So carbon neutrality, Monday, Society of American Foresters, academic report coming out that actually offers a summary and a critique of all of the reports that have been out there to date and the models, I believe, including the one that we're referencing in the Nature magazine. All of these models say the same. So if you look at the one you're referencing in Nature magazine, what they're assuming in that model, the data that they're using in that model, is that harvest, is that bioenergy is being made out of 100-year-old boreal forests, or old growth forests, or saw timber is being used. In any model that you look at, when you look at what is actually being used in the bioenergy industry, which is low-grade wood fiber, you get very good carbon benefits. Don't take my word for that. Take the word of 12,000, you know, U.S. foresters and scientists out there that will be publishing this report on Monday.
Last minute, Dana.
Well, that's certainly not what the DEC report found. I guess in closing, I just want to say I really do appreciate the opportunity to have this discussion and debate, and I know we're on the opposite sides of the fence here on this issue. This is critical. I mean, the future of forests and how we're going to treat forests moving into the future, right? This is where it's being defined right now. This is a global debate about the use of forests as a primary fuel source for generating electricity versus, you know, maintaining, protecting forests as vital carbon sinks as a strategy for mitigating and adapting to climate change into the future. And this global debate is playing out in the biggest way right here in this region in the southern U.S. And so this is critical that you guys are here, and this debate needs to continue in the media. We need to continue to drive the discussion about, you know, what is the role of forests in the context of climate change, and what do we want to see in terms of the future? What is our vision for the future? And is it more forest destruction, more logging, or is it more forest protection?
On that note, I really appreciate each of our speakers, Scott Barrett, Seth Ginter, and Dan Smith, for coming on a Saturday at their expense to New Orleans to be with us to discuss this issue. I appreciate it very much. There is a resource list with links at the back. It will also be online, so you don't have to type anything on the URL. You can click on it. But please take one and make me feel better. And there will be a break area to your right with our exhibitors. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.